I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World. We're talking about novelists as prophets. The Iranian Azar Nafisi was just speaking about grand old dead ones like Tolstoy. Before her, Amin Maalouf was speaking as a living witness of tribalism, East and West. Amitav Ghosh is a rising star among the post-colonial writers in the Salman Rushdie constellation of novelists from the other side of the British Empire. Early on in the bombing, slogging war with Iraq, he was dismayed at how little Americans have absorbed about the perils of empire for everybody.
I felt a profound sense of despair. We have achieved so little in making, as it were, the world aware of the real dangers of empire, you know, of what is implicit in the whole business of launching upon an empire. And this became clear to me recently when I was having conversations with various people in America who, you know, displayed to me in conversations such a truly shocking ignorance of, you know, the very complex history of empire. It just made me realize that for them, they saw empire really, whichever side of empire they may be on, they saw it merely as the projection of force, which it isn't at all. You know, I mean, empire is essentially, it's the circumstance of remaking, reinventing a reality that you meet. It's the fantasy of the creator in some sense, you know.
Amitav Ghosh has lots to tell you about empire. First, that it's always been about capturing minds as well as resources. Second, that the imperial enterprise typically leads its masters to excess and its opponents over the edge into horrific madness. Third, that this newborn consciousness of American empire could be the closing chapter in the history of several centuries. Fourth, that the old European masters of empire are happily out of the business. And fifth, from his perspective as an Indian who now lives, writes, and raises his American children in Manhattan, Americans look unprepared for the global mastery that we've stumbled into.
I think it really is a sort of turning point in history. Really. I mean, we've come to the culmination of one very, very long process. I think it's something that I would call, you know, the Anglophone Empire. And I've actually seen this process develop in America over the last 10 years. And it's been very, very disturbing to me, you know, because when I first arrived in America, you know, the first time I visited America was in 1988. And at that time, empire was really a bad word. America was still in the at a moment when the word empire really was redolent of Ronald Reagan's evil empire and so on. And, you know, after the Soviet Union fell, straight away, you know, my deepest misgivings were really about what it implied for the future of America.
Amitav Ghosh is a novelist, a child of post-colonial India. His father was a lieutenant colonel with the British Indian Army in the Bridge Over the River Kwai Burma campaign against the Japanese in World War II. Amitav was born in the India that Mahatma Gandhi had liberated from the Brits. But that English-speaking empire, he says, never died.
I'm talking about a project which has been in the making for 300 years, yeah. Imagine yourself to be a historian from Mars, you know. I mean, who arrives on the planet Earth and, you know, looks at the history of the planet Earth. How would you read its history? About 500 years ago, a small group of people from a small island began to expand outwards. Today, in effect, they control really three continents. And it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, this amazing sort of global diaspora. And there's no word for it. So, you know, if you look at this phenomenon, which is perfectly self-evident to people everywhere in the world, you know, that this group of Anglophone countries really has, in some sense, shouldered the responsibility for running the world. But it's not just shouldered the responsibility, it's also shouldered all the benefits. Not only that, if you look at, say, the global media, let's say just the global voice, it's almost overwhelmingly dominated by, Hollywood, you know, Australians, Americans, Canadians, British figure in it almost completely to the exclusion of everybody else. So if you look at it from the world outside, you know, you can see in some sense that this is a project which has really reached, as it were, its complete culmination, which is absolute global dominance and absolute control of all resources, but not absolute control of the global mind.
Amitav Ghosh's masterpiece, titled The Glass Palace, is an epic of the British in Burma over the span of a century. It reads at moments like a parable of the U.S. in Iraq, but it was written before 9/11, and it's rooted in real history, starting in 1885, the shock and awe of British forces that captured Burma and its teak forests and its oil.
Burma's a very good example. You know, in 1885, when the British fought the Third Anglo-Burmese War, when they actually destroyed the Kingdom of Burma, it was preceded by exactly this narrative. The King Thibaw of Burma was set up as a tyrant, a bloodthirsty murderer who'd murdered hundreds of people. And in fact, he, you know, in some way, he, none of those, I mean, all those conclusions, you know, if you read history in a certain way, could be justified. So the idea was, so that was the first preceding narrative. Then the second one is that, you know, he's not only is he a tyrant, he's sitting on a whole heap of oil. Because remember, Burma was the first country to produce oil. You know, Burma Shell oil of today was actually Burma Shell, you know. So they wanted, you know, he was sitting on oil, he was sitting on teak, he was sitting on gems, he was sitting on a lot of minerals, which were very important for the time. So, you know, there was this dual narrative. One, that, you know, there's a tyrant and, you know, we have to liberate Burma. And the other, you know, there is also, you know, this whole world of mineral resources. So they go off. And it's very, they go off with this sort of display of shock and awe, a very powerful army, completely sort of outgunned the local people. The local people fought fierce little sort of battles of resistance, but they were completely overrun, you know. They used gunships in a way that they'd never been used before in the Asian continent. And, you know, within a matter of days, this place collapsed. What's very interesting is if you look at the English version of this, because, I mean, the English version is all we have. You know, Burmese hardly wrote about it. But for them, this is never called an invasion. It's always called a campaign of pacification, you know. But, you know, what is a campaign of pacification? I mean, after that, Burma became the great oil producer. One single sort of port in Burma used to export perhaps more than the rest of India put together, you know. But at the end of it, it's a completely broken place.
For all the oil in Burma then, or in Iraq today, he observes that imperial conquest is never just about seizing resources. It's bigger than that. Empire is the business of reinventing the world in our image. It's the fantasy of the creator. It presents itself as a high-minded, improving project. The Spanish and Portuguese had a church blessing to convert the heathen. The British were certain that real freedom consisted of living under British rule. The storyline is always that we're here to help you. Problem is, the storyline is too good to be true, as illustrated in Ghosh's novel, The Glass Palace.
You know, there's a section in this which has to do with a plantation owner, and it's a kind of metaphorical section, you know. He's running a perfect plantation, you know. Every rubber tree is meant to be alike. It's meant to be absolutely perfect. And one day, there's a scene there where one day he tells his friend that, you know, even within this perfection, you can always find a tree which decides to fight the pattern. And I think that's human nature. It's simply impossible. No matter how perfect a system America may embody or that Britain may embody, simply because it's a system that you want to make, as it were, the only system for the whole world, everybody in the world will resist it. Because it's outside the human condition to reconcile ourselves to, you know, the idea of such singularity. You know, human beings simply cannot live in a circumstance where there's only one way of life. It's impossible for us to imagine that. That would be, for human beings, the most absolute kind of tyranny. It doesn't matter whether that's a very enlightened way of life. It could be the most enlightened way of life. But simply because it's singular, it would arouse all the hostilities of the whole world. You see, one of the things that we see, you know, in that results from empire is that empire, in this process of remolding, because an empire actually recreates the world within, within a certain image, if you like, or, you know, recasts it in the direction of in the form of another image, what happens thereafter is that all the ills of the world come to attach to that empire, whether it's responsible for it or not. So, I mean, for example, you know, if you travel around colonial countries, you know, countries that have once been colonized, you can see that, you know, what the British are held responsible for, you know, often, is not just the ills that, you know, that they're responsible for, but for every ill. And indeed, in a sense, they are responsible for every ill. So, you know, there's a very sort of complex relationship there. I mean, for the English as well, the whole idea was, you know, to set people free as they conceived it. Only this freedom, for the English always, freedom consisted of being under English rule. So you can imagine that for many people in the world, they didn't see it in the same way. And I was very struck, you know, when I was researching my book, The Glass Palace, I interviewed so many, you know, ex-Indian Army soldiers who'd actually fought in these colonial wars. You know, I mean, who'd fought for the British in the colonial wars. And, you know, many of them later became rebels against the British. You know, they joined movements against the British. And I'd ask them, you know, how did this happen that you suddenly, you know, you were fighting for the British and then suddenly one minute you turned against them? And you know what they all said? They said, you know, there came a time when we realized that for these people, what freedom meant is being under their rule, under their control. For them means freedom. That's what the word means to them. And that was when we realized that we didn't want to be a part of that particular project.
The crushing burden of empire on identity is personified in the Glass Palace in the soldier Arjun. He's an Indian fighting, as Ghosh's father did, with the British Army in Southeast Asia. Late in the game, he realizes that he's been had. He's just brown-skinned cannon fodder in an imperial project, and he goes berserk. Ghosh's point is that empire creates a conflict of loyalties, an impossible dilemma.
And there comes to him a moment when he's facing defeat at the hands of the Japanese in northern Malaysia. And he has, as it were, this sort of epiphany where he sees that, you know, where he asks himself, who am I and what am I doing? And he realizes that even though he's fighting for the British, he's always been marginalized within this army, that he and other Indians have been, as it were, the cannon fodder for this army. And at that moment, unlike, say, anti-colonial rebels of 1857, Arjun comes from a generation which actually has completely accepted the premises of the British universe. You know, he feels that, you know, what the British have offered is a kind of meritocracy. Suddenly, when he's in the army, he discovers that that's not quite the case. And that's when he reaches this really terrifying conclusion.
Here's his character Arjun speaking to his mate Hardy at a moment of truth.
Just look at us, Hardy. Just look at us. What are we? We've learned to dance the tango, and we know how to eat roast beef with a knife and fork. The truth is that except for the color of our skin, most people in India wouldn't even recognize us as Indians. When we joined up, we didn't have India on our minds. We wanted to be sahibs, and that's what we've become. But the empire was dead now. He knew this because he had felt it die within himself, where it had held its strongest dominion. And with whom was he now to keep faith? Loyalty, commonality, faith. These things were as essential and as fragile as the muscles of the human heart. Easy to destroy, impossible to rebuild. How would one begin the work of recreating the tissue that bound people to each other? This was beyond the abilities of someone such as himself, someone trained to destroy. It was a labor that would last not 1 year, not 10, not 50. It was the work of centuries. Those of us who've seen the empire, you know, really from our end, it's the conclusion which really humbles you, that when you look at it, in the end, the empire has made everything you know. It's the only past you have. And it's to cross that Rubicon is a very difficult thing. And that's why, in some sense, you know, what's even more difficult than empire is the opposition to empire. Because one thing that we see about hegemony, which is for us, which is for me at least, the most frightening thing about hegemony, is that all opposition to hegemony ultimately becomes grotesque. It takes on grotesque forms.
The diabolical attack on civilians in the World Trade Center, or the grotesqueness of Palestinian suicide bombers, fit all too familiarly in Amitav Ghosh's history of empire.
You can see exactly the same process operating in the Middle East, really, where, you know, many, many Arabs, I'm sure, feel a great deal of sympathy for the forms of opposition that have been springing up. And yet, when they look at it, they say that, you know, this project is going to destroy us. We will be the first to be destroyed by this.
As in the Intifada or the attack on the World Trade Center.
Exactly. So, you know, in some really terrible way, you can see some sort of ghastly history playing itself out here, you know. One very good example, you know, is the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, which was, again, you know, a sort of nationalist project in the end. But, you know, one of the strangest elements of the Khmer Rouge massacres is that they were not killing another ethnic group.
Exactly.
They were killing themselves.
Yes.
But it was done under the guise of killing the enemy within. And the enemy within was the group of people that had, as it were, incorporated aspects of colonialism. You know, so it was always the middle class. You know, his whole idea was to, he stopped the circulation of money, he destroyed the schools, he destroyed the books. But what was it really? Because he himself, Pol Pot, was educated in France, you know. And, you know, he was sent there. It was possible for him to go to France because he had an aunt who was a famous dancer. And she was a mistress of one of the members of the royal family. And she kept him in the palace, you know. And so he was brought up within the royal palace, you know. And then he went to France where he was radicalized. And then he came back from France. And, you know, one of the most appalling things about this whole thing is that eventually the Khmer, he got his own men to slice the breasts of his aunt. You know, it becomes almost a physical metaphor of rooting out everything in yourself that you recognize to be in any way indebted to that past, to that compromised past. And that's what becomes, you know, this absolute grotesqueness. I think that certainly, you know, the bin Laden variety of fundamentalism is exactly a sort of replica of this. You know, you see here a man who's just completely internalized, you know, Western forms of organization, Western forms of knowledge, and who's launched upon
airplanes and cell phones and
that's right.
credit cards and
so many of those young, you know, Arab militants in Afghanistan were wearing Dolce and Gabbana. You know, I mean, it really makes you think. So you know, but the project that they're launched upon is completely. I mean, it's a project which in some sense, can only succeed at the cost of destroying the people who embody it, you know. So, I mean, in some way, that's the sort of horror of it.
India, he says, was an exception. It was a colony that created a democracy in the face of empire.
And I think that's really Gandhi's greatness, you know, that that we in India were rescued from this fate, you know, is really just a tribute to Gandhi, who recognized that, you know, if at this point we want to dig out of our hearts everything in it that's English, in the end we will only mutilate ourselves, you know. And I think that's his greatness, that he recognized that, you know, whether we like it or not, history has happened and we have to make our peace with it.
Amitabh Ghosh still doubts that Americans, on the whole, buy into their imperial role.
I think in America things often flip over quite quickly. And I think we're beginning to see the beginnings of that. And you really wonder in retrospect, one day people will wake up and say, who dreamt this dream, you know?
A dream or a nightmare? Of course we can't be sure yet. The news events don't often explain themselves. Life is short, art is long. The story in all of these stories is yet to be written. Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison at transim.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kaya Wilson, Justin Grote-Lucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.
PRI, Public Radio International.